Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Kemshad Rashida, who is the author of Take Back Control, A Surgeon's Guide to Healing Your Spine Without Medications or Surgery. Dr. Rashida is an orthopedic spine surgeon who has personal experience with pain from injury as well as surgeries, and the clinical experience to know that surgery is not always the best option. As he says, a chance to cut is not necessarily a chance to cure. And he has personal experience with mind-body medicine and holistic alternatives for what is really an epidemic in this country of chronic back pain and neck pain. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you want to give the listening audience a little bit of history of how you came to write the book?
Yes. I'm, as you said, an orthopedic spine surgeon. I've been practicing now in San Diego for 20 years. And my practice, it was interesting how it had evolved. When we first started out, I did 400 cases as a fellow, and originally all we did was decompress nerves and take pressure off of the spine or stabilize the spine in times when there was mainly nerve problems or instability. Then gradually, it seemed that we as surgeons were more, as a society, more trying to treat back pain and neck pain. And then there was this push called cage rage, where essentially we're putting cages then in this to fuse them. And so I started seeing, instead of on one side a lot of successes with patients with arm pain or leg pain or paralysis or other problems that we were fixing, on the other side I was seeing patients with back pain where we were trying to fix it, but it wouldn't get fixed. So they'd come back with more and more pain. They would, for example, be stuck on large amounts of narcotics for extended periods of time. They'd need spinal cord stimulators. And this has only gotten worse over the past 20 years. So then I was lucky enough to associate myself at that time with a professor at UC San Diego who was involved with a lot of research on strengthening of the spine and how that affects pain and the perception of pain and how well patients can do with really extensive strengthening of the core muscles. And I was surprised at how well even patients that I would classically have thought needed operations were doing with appropriate non-operative care. So it's been about now more than a decade of really focusing on this population and realizing that we're operating way, way too much.
Yes, there's functional medical problems, and then there's anatomical medical problems. And if you know, everybody wants an MRI when they have back or neck pain. You know that. They come into your office requesting one. And MRIs only show up anatomical problems, not functional problems. For example, some patients in my patient population, because they have silicone throughout their body that gets infected, their neck or back pain can be cured with antibiotics because it's really an infection around a foreign body that happens to be near the spine, which is interesting. I've even biopsied silicone nodules in the skin on the back. So we know the silicone goes all over the body. So bacterial infections wouldn't show up on an MRI. They wouldn't respond to surgery. In fact, they'd get worse, as you know. And so it's not a real common cause of back pain, but if you fail to diagnose it, then you're in real trouble. On the other hand, I think you've had instances, as I have, of patients being seen for a long period of time in a clinic, getting pain medicine, and then somebody finally orders a study and they have metastatic disease to the spine, which is an anatomical problem. So, you know, we have to determine the cause of back and neck pain. It's very, very important.
Yes, and have, and this is why I've had this mission over this past 10 years, because I really feel like, in especially when it comes to spine, we are so disjointed as a healthcare system. We have physical therapists, chiropractors, acupuncturists, exercise physiologists, surgeons, injectionists. Everybody is in a bit of a silo of their own, and we're not cooperating and saying, well, what is the best treatment? Sometimes the best treatment is surgery, but I mean, that's rarely the case. Like, you know, or in your case, the case you were describing, you know, catching somebody who has a cancer, you know, you want to be able to catch that and get that MRI early. There's so many people where you don't need that MRI early, and in fact, getting that MRI and focusing on their anatomic problem is a mistake, because then they don't realize the other causes for their back pain. And so often, back pain is caused by bad habits, lack of strength, our own psyche. Our own way of kind of catastrophizing our situation, mm-hmm. and focusing on our core, which is what happens with kind of psychological distress. It gets focused in the core of our body. So if we all work together, in other words, and we had a situation like we've established here in San Diego, where there are a lot of different disciplines all under the same roof for the betterment of the patient. That, I think, is a better approach for a disease than everybody being in their own kind of compartments and doing what they do best, but not talking to each other and doing what's best for the patient.
Yeah, that's a real problem. As I said earlier, I deal a lot with silicone patients who have digestive disorders, and they quit absorbing amino acids. And when they do that, they develop a more rapid onset of degenerative disc disease, not just there, but also rotator cuff disease. Any ligament or any structural problem becomes worse because they have amino acid deficits. So fixing the gut is very important. And I put them on Calirad, which is a supplement that I found. And there's other supplements similar to it. I just use the liquid one because it's easier absorbed. It's just collagen. And that really helps low back pain if it's due to these structural problems. But a lot of times it's due to arthritis. And you talk about arthritis in your book. There's ankylosing spondylitis, which hits the spine. There's all sorts of other arthritises. But joint inflammation is something that is actually very poorly understood. But it's very, very important to treat the cause of that. My patients almost all have arthritis if they have silicone toxicity. And I found that silicone itself can cause arthritis because it's an adjuvant. And other things can cause it as well that are very common, including wheat allergy. Many of them, because of their gut situation, have a wheat allergy that causes joint pain. As they go off wheat, their joint pain goes away. And then bad fats, old salad dressings, old degenerated like almond butters will degenerate joints. And I know this through personal experience because one of my joints just degenerated when I was on a bad fat. And I think most people don't know that that can happen. There's other things like degenerative. You know that one because you see all these patients with injuries. A significant injury may lead to degenerative arthritis or repetitive motion at the base of the thumb. I do a lot of hand surgery, so we see the CMC arthritis. And in that case, you need to try to build up the cartilage. And we use supplements like liposomal C-flex joint, which is a liposomal form of both glucosamine and chondroitin that over 6 to 12 weeks will build up cartilage. And my father had a really bad MRI of his neck, and he had neck pain. I put him on the supplement, and 12 weeks later, he had no neck pain, and he had repeated MRIs because he had prostate cancer, and they were looking at his neck, and his MRI totally cleared up because he was given the right supplement that caused the cartilage to build back up in his neck, which was really interesting. then intracellular infection is the cause of most inflammatory arthritis. There's an article by Dr. Garth Nicholson showing that half of all rheumatoid arthritis is mycoplasma, and I can assure you the other half is spirochete. And if you treat the actual inflammatory arthritis, then the arthritis goes away. And I have many patients with no rheumatoid arthritis anymore because we actually treated the spirochete. And fortunately, you don't always have to use antibiotics to do that. There's other alternative ways to treat the spirochete, which are located inside the cells. And then this is a very interesting one. Red wines from California that have high levels of fluorine in them can cause arthritis. So that's another one that I test for. And what I usually do, and then arachidonic acid, too much arachidonic acid in eggs and meat, and then too much uric acid. You're familiar with that one. Too much uric mm-hmm. acid can inflame joints. So I use applied kinesiology to determine the cause of the joint pain, and then I treat the cause. And sometimes there's more than one cause. And if you treat all the causes, the joint pain goes away, which is really what we need to start doing in medicine, is determining the cause of the disease.
Yes, I think, it's fascinating. Your experience in some of these areas is very interesting. I'd love to learn more about it. And I'll add to what you've said about arthritis and inflammatory conditions, which mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more research and things we need to have in this regard. You've had, your experience with silicone and some of the other dietary reasons is a very good one. But the other reason you quoted was infectious as far as like bacterial. And it's interesting, there was a study recently of patients with chronic back pain, and the cause was a very slow growing bacteria called Propionibacter. And
right.
Interestingly, for 70%...
I read that article.
Yeah, and so, there are a lot of these reasons, like as you're stating. So I think if you are a chronic back patient, one of the advices I think that and which I think you're saying the same thing is trying to eliminate, looking at dietary reasons, trying to eliminate the possible causes that are dietary, and I outline some of them in the book, and there's a lot more information.
You do. You have a lot of really good information in the book.
But also secondarily, at the end, you are stuck. Some disc conditions, once they degenerate past a certain point, I've not found them to get better with anything other than your body's own strength can actually be an amazing factor that improves the stability and decreases the pain. For example, the same thing happens in the knee and the shoulder. When you get a degenerative knee or a degenerative shoulder, a lot of times if you stabilize the muscles around the knee, for example, the vastus medialis is one of them, and also the hip, the supporting muscles that help knee mechanics, as well as in the shoulder, when you stabilize the rotator cuff, it's mm-hmm. incredible how you can deal with even significant levels of arthritis without any functional deficit. So it's actually very important to hit this with everything you have, not just the diet, not just the understanding, not just the cognitive side, but also, letting the body heal itself, because it does thrive on activity. And you need to feed it. That's also just as nourishing as all these other factors we've discussed.
There's one thing I want to tell you about that you can look out for in your patient population. And remember that women don't always tell you that they have implants. A lot of times they didn't tell their insurance company, and they're not going to put it down on any medical record. So you have to ask them directly. But if somebody has a ruptured silicone implant that leaks out, the silicone leaks out, gets in the axillary lymph nodes, and then gets infected, they get a frozen shoulder. Isn't that interesting?
Mm. Interesting.
And so treatment is obviously removal of the implant, removal of the lymph nodes that are infected, but then they need surgery to get the shoulder moving again. That's the only thing that works. Exercise will not work. It just won't. But then you're dealing with something different than what most people have with a rotator cuff, something very, very different.
Right.
It's actually
right.
an infected foreign body.
That is fascinating. That is fascinating. And you're right. There are times, like, for example, if a frozen shoulder is truly frozen and you cannot get it going with surgery, you have
you
to manipulate
surgery.
You have to break up. Yeah, you have to break up. And the surgery is very easy. Essentially, all you do is just manipulate it under anesthesia and tear up the adhesions, and then you have to rehab it. But you're right. I mean, this is a fascinating, you know, kind of new area to me now, and I'm going to be focusing on this.
So keep your eyes open. One other thing I want to mention. I want to mention something about patients, and then I want to mention something about us as surgeons, because I found something that will help you. But if patients have a fibromyalgia-type picture, they almost always have neck pain, and that's because of all the trigger points, and I'm sure you're aware of that. But it's a magnesium malic acid deficiency. There's a Krebs cycle disruption, and they need magnesium and malic acid, pretty large doses, or they can use magnesium cream right on the shoulder, but the neck pain goes away. Now, I don't know if you see that. You may not, because you're seeing more, you know, more structural problems. But you know how often surgeons like you and I have to undergo surgery for degenerative disc disease of the neck, because we have our heads bent down during surgery. Well, they did a study in the plastic surgery department of a major university, because several of the attendings had to have surgery, and they did a study where half the surgeons wore neck braces, just a soft collar, and the other half didn't. And the ones that wore neck braces didn't have to have any more treatment. So it's about $3 for a soft collar. I always wear a soft collar because, like you, I'm in surgery often 12 to even 16 hours a day, and we're operating through about a 4-centimeter incision the entire chest wall. So you can imagine what that does when you're turning your neck. And I know what you do in spine surgery. So basically, if you wear that collar, you may really prevent that forward head position or other positions, bad posture, which you talk about so well in your book. So you might want to try that one.
That's a great advice, and I have something for you on the other end too. I also suffer, just like you said, like almost every surgeon I think has some element of neck pain because of the prolonged bad posture and bad neck position.
Right.
And there's technology out there now that's been tested for over 40 years with strengthening of the core muscles of the neck and the low back, and these machines that we use in our San Diego Spine Zone clinics are unbelievable for me. It's my savior. If I strengthen at least once every other week, it only takes about 15 minutes because it isolates the muscles so well that if my posterior musculature is well strengthened, I don't have neck pain, and it actually lasts. If I have a few months of time where I'm not doing it, let's say I've been very non-compliant, and then I have to do it a little bit more frequently before I build that strength back up. But in maintenance, I can maintain it very well. So it really takes gaining that strength and then maintaining it. These machines are great because what they can do is they can measure your strength, and there's a lot of data on what average strength is for a non-symptomatic patient. And so you can see how you stack up. And if you stack up really low, and especially at the beginning, I was shocked. I'm an athlete. I felt like, oh, I'm so strong. Why is my strength curve so low? And this is what we noticed. Even we've had professional tennis players where their strength curve in their low back is 2 standard deviations below the standard normal population. So why is that? It's because your back muscles are being inhibited due to pain. So if you have the right machines to strengthen, you can overcome a lot of this.
I've used the posture pump personally. Have you ever used that? They have a lumbar and a cervical posture pump. Do you know who Dr. Norm Shealy is? He's a neurosurgeon, invented the TENS unit.
I know of him. I don't know him personally.
Well, he did studies on the posture pump. You know, the disc hydrate when we're sleeping, and so it's important to drink a lot of water right before you go to bed, even though you might have to get up and go to the bathroom. And he he did this study, this MRI study, that after 20 minutes on the posture pump, and all it does is put the curvature back in. And in your book, you talk about this, but you say use rolled towels. But this is actually a pump that puts the curvature back in the neck and in the lumbar area. And it's really great after car wrecks because, as you know, those straighten out when they shouldn't be straight. And so the disc hydrate in that position, and he showed that all these bulging discs just went away after 20 minutes on the posture pump. So isn't that interesting?
That is interesting. And, you know, that's a controversial area in some area, in some ways. I do think that there are a lot of ways in which you can increase your disc height and increase the hydration. As you said, when you sleep, it's amazing. If you can check your height against the wall before and after you wake up, before and after you sleep, you'll notice a big, significant difference. And there are a lot of other techniques, like using an inversion table, for example. And
you can use
that during the day and just use it for a few minutes. And it's amazing how if you keep this hydration, this pump in your body primed, it will keep the nutrition in it, and it'll get rid of the waste factors and bring nutrition in the disc. And that's really what you want. And so I like it. Things like this, like, as you mentioned, maybe this posture pump, but there's a lot of other ones out there. I would, as a consumer.
Oh, yeah, no, there are many different ones.
I would make sure as a consumer that everybody, you find different ways to constantly keep your back hydrated, like you're saying, with both nutritional by just drinking more water, but also doing other restful but also kind of stretching type activities that pull fluid back into the disc.
Yeah, that's true. And the other big problem, which I know you see a lot of, is osteoporosis. My mother had it, and she was bending over one day just picking up leaves and broke a rib. So, you know, you can imagine. And she had compression fractures in her back. And so osteoporosis is often treated with Fosamax and other drugs that don't necessarily have good long-term outcomes, especially because it makes the bones too brittle. But I've done a lot of research on it, obviously because I have it genetically, that whole-body vibration is really a great treatment for osteoporosis, along with the appropriate bone factors. Austinol is one of the supplements with bone factors and that some people need. And then the other boron, strontium, and other, you know, less common things that are needed to make bone, like vitamin D, vitamin K, that kind of thing. You know, the regular support things are important. But whole body vibration, there's a bunch of scientific studies showing that that really can treat osteoporosis. And it's not something that would be real intuitive. I don't think people would really understand why that works.
Well, I think I do think it makes sense to me. Intuitively to me, the part that makes sense to me is that bone is laid down when you stress it appropriately. So what happens when you're in, let's say, with a vibrational type stress on the body or with exercise, both those things. What happens is that your body has a natural reflex either with vibration or with exercise, and as your tendons are pulling on your muscle, on your bone, then you're going to stress it to
lay
a point
more
where
bone.
You get your brain bone. So it does make sense to me, but there's great studies on strengthening, on how much appropriate strengthening, especially for the back, can increase bone density. Like these same machines I was discussing with you have a lot of history with increasing bone density and doing it safely and very, very quickly in a 10-week program. So there's a lot of different factors, and the key is appropriate stress of your body. It's not overstressing it, but getting enough, both gravity as well as exercise and muscle pull to increase the signal for building bone.
Yeah, I want to mention one thing that you mentioned in your book that I think is important for people to understand. A lot of times lasers are used as advertising tools. And, you know, plastic surgeons advertise that they cut the skin with a laser, or spine surgeons advertise they use laser in a spine surgery. And both you and I know that lasers, although they have a place, they do not really have a place being used for advertising.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, this is a real, unfortunately, it's a very, very commonly used advertising technique. And I see it, you know, manifest in a way where people, again, are looking for that magic cure and think that the laser is going to be my magic cure. So you end up making decisions based on this marketing as a consumer that I think are not the wisest. Laser is a tool, and it can be used. I mean, there are very good, I mean, lasers are used in the eye very effectively. Lasers are used in some type, very, very small subset of patients for spine surgery, where we use an endoscopic surgery and try to kind of shrink the disc in some areas, because you can use a right angle type device with a laser to do that. But really, generally, it's not a very widely used, and in and of itself, it's not a cure. So this, you know, kind of one inch incision and a lifetime of no pain thought process is not really a good one.
Right. Now, I want to pick your brain, because you probably know a lot more about this topic than I do. It seems that some of the pharmaceutical companies are going toward the idea that we can inject things into joints and make them function again. Is there truth to that? And if so, what should people look for when they're talking to their orthopedic doctors?
Well, that's a wide topic. So the type of injections that we do in joints are vary from injecting steroids to injecting what's called PRP, platelet-rich plasma, to other type of hypertonic solutions, essentially concentrated sugar solutions into joints and tendons for other reasons. And so I think for temporary joints, for example, for knees, a lot of times using, you know, steroid injection can be a short-term improvement, but it does eat up the joint too. So I'm not a huge advocate of this type of injections. The other is these, PRP has...
It's almost like stem cell, would you say?
It's kind of like your own stem cell, but it's really not exactly your stem cells, because it's your blood that you spin and get the platelet-rich aspects of it. So yes, it's a little bit more concentrated, but it's not exactly, it's not a classic stem cell. But it can increase inflammation, and it can increase the amount of healing. And, you know, there are some conditions. For example, tendonitis that comes from tennis elbow. You actually want to increase the inflammation in that area so the body can heal it. So in some ways, injecting into that tendon makes sense, and I think that would be a good idea. For the back, there's been a bunch of research on injecting different factors into the disc to see if it can regenerate. And there's some good animal studies that some of these growth factors and some other, other combination of factors are going to be helpful. And there's a couple FDA studies going on right now in different parts of the U.S. I have not yet been enamored by any of these. So I think in essence, my conclusion would be that the jury is out yet. There's some encouraging results. Some people have shown them in scientific meetings where I go, wow, the disc, look at that before and after. It looks amazing. But we don't have enough research where I would say, look, this is a good option right now.
About 3 weeks ago, I had two patients come into the clinic on the same day, and I diagnosed them both with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which, as you know, is very rare. And for two to come in the same day is amazing. But what about for them? They have a lot of joint pain, and they have ligament laxity. I mean, extreme ligament laxity. Would they benefit maybe from PRP?
Yes, I do think, you know, this, again, is not studied, but I think it's a good thought. As you know, those Ehlers-Danlos patients are very tough because that ligament laxity puts so much pressure on joints because they have to work on, and they're obviously a lot of times much taller, so there's a lot more of a lever on each of their joints. I don't know of any research in using PRP for those patients, but it does make sense. But again, it's a stiffening compound, and even you know, like we were talking about these hyperosmolar type injections where they result in kind of shrinkage of tissue like that. Those kind of injections may be helpful.
I read an article the other day. I haven't tried it yet. I do have lichen sclerosis patients because I do a lot of labiaplasties, and there's a PRP injection into the area of the lichen sclerosis in the female perineum that's really helping the lichen sclerosis. So that's another interesting thing of PRP. I think PRP is very, we don't know all the things that might help yet.
Yeah, it's very early in the process, but we are there. We do have a study here in San Diego going along with both PRP and using adipose tissue and injecting into the disc. But as I said, I think it's a little too early to make grandiose comments about it. But more,
right.
You know, it's very interesting because it's a very minimally invasive way that if it works out, would be nice.
Well, I'll give you a clue about stem cells. The belly fat, you know, not the stuff inside the abdomen, but the stuff that women get outside the abdomen and the lower abdomen, that's rich in stem cells. We know that because we do fat transfer to the breast, and we've determined that stem cells are most in the belly fat. So if you're trying to transfer the patient's own stem cells via fat, try the belly. It's got the most of them.
That's what this study protocol uses, is the belly fat, exactly. And that's the thought process. And I think it's nice if there's really truly a high enough concentration and truly that they can differentiate into disc type cells that you know there's a chance that this is going to help.
Yeah, it really will. So you mentioned minimally invasive spine surgery. There must be some advantages to that, just like there is to laparoscopic surgery and abdominal surgery. What do you think of minimally invasive surgery for the back?
I'm a big advocate of minimally invasive surgery, and it's been one of those trends in spine surgery that I think is very, very useful, because essentially the goal of minimally invasive surgery is to do what you need to at the spine level, but without any muscle, with minimal muscle tendon to get there. So the key is to differentiate a minimally invasive surgery that still does the same thing at the spine level to kind of a minimally effective surgery, just because it's minimally invasive, meaning that these touted surgeries like laser surgery or, you know, a lot of these minimally invasive type of surgeries that are not really doing the same thing at the spine level, I would not pursue those. But going to somebody who's had years of experience with minimally invasive surgery, because it does take a big, like you've seen with other types of surgery, there is a learning curve. And so you don't want to catch someone on the early end of that learning curve. But if you do a standard surgery like a laminectomy or a fusion minimally invasively, there's a massive difference in the infection rate, in the blood loss, in the hospital stay. And I've been very encouraged by that. But again, it's the same. We're doing the same thing at the spine level. We're taking the pressure off the nerves. We're putting screws in to stabilize where there's instability, and yet we're doing it all with kind of robotic and image guided ways that allow us to see down deep in the spine without having to open up all the muscle to get down there.
So I know a lot of your book is about avoiding surgery, but before we get back to the mind-body and the other, you know, the other non-surgical things that people need to treat, and we can talk a little bit about the dangers of narcotics as well, What do you see as the future for spine surgery?
I am somewhat fearful of the future for spine surgery because of it being overdone. And so I do think it has a very good future in that there's a lot of advances we have yet to make. So if I think if we focus as a group, if we focus on trying not to just use surgery as a fix for everything, yet use it judiciously, I think we're going to be in good shape. I think that the problem is right now it takes up such a large, a abnormally large percentage of the dollars spent on healthcare our society might say, we're not going to cover this, which would then be a disaster because there's so much good that can be done with spine surgery in the right times. So I'm bullish on it in that I think we do great work, but I'm hesitant because I think we're ahead of ourselves in that way. And that's really the focus of this whole, my book, as well as kind of this consumer push to have people, you know, pick the right choices.
Yeah. Like you probably, like me, have seen a lot of car accidents, and car accidents are interesting because the neck and low back are often injured. And, of course, everybody gets an MRI, and a lot of people have never had a neck MRI before, but when you look at it, it's horrible. I mean, they've got all sorts of stuff, and they never knew they had it, and they probably had it before the car wreck, but you know, you can't really show that some of the things might be from the wreck, but a lot of the other things might not be from the wreck. And then you probably had patients who've had MRIs that don't show hardly anything wrong but have really severe neck pain, because they've got neurological problems, facet injuries, you know, all sorts of things that aren't going to show up. So this is the danger of using an MRI to justify surgery.
Oh, yes, exactly. And there's great studies on this, on how the normal population has a significant chance of having an abnormality on an MRI scan, and it's completely asymptomatic, and it means nothing, and you shouldn't really focus on it. So it's correlating what the MRI scan findings are with the patient. Like you were describing a auto accident, and yes, an auto accident, if you do have some conditions in your neck and some degeneration that's even been asymptomatic, it can push you over the edge a little bit and can cause inflammation to start and pain to start in that area. But did it cause all those problems? No. And can you return back to a pain-free state if you appropriately rehab it, your neck, and you do the right things with your posture and you have the right mentality? Yes. So meaning that's where, as you said, as a patient, you shouldn't be concentrating on, oh my God, my MRI scan says severe disc this or severe foraminal impingement or all these kind of things. Focus on your function, focus on your condition, and focus on your muscle strength and overall rehab, and then you'll see that a lot of these conditions will return back to being asymptomatic.
Your book goes into detail on posture, which is so important, and diet, and too much inflammatory foods. And you mentioned the benefit of the oils for decreasing inflammation, and just our lifestyle in general, our sitting lifestyle. You got great diagrams in the book. So this is probably why so much of our population have abnormal MRIs.
Yes, and that's a very key point. You know, in the past, everybody would there was a lot more activity. I think right now, this sitting and as I quote, professor who's quoted this saying, you know, sitting is the new smoking, and I think it's very true in that it is an incredible problem, because especially for discs, the discs don't have any actual blood supply going to them. They're the largest avascular structure in the body. So a disc is a pretty large structure. And imagine if it does not have any blood supply and you're essentially squeezing it with sitting in the wrong posture for a long period of time, all those chemical builds up, all the acidity starts building up in that disc, and it's much more likely to become arthritic.
And there's a whole thing. As I was reading through your book, we do a lot of detox here because obviously there's a crap load of chemicals in those silicone implants that we have to get out of the body because they're carcinogens and neurotoxins, and they're causing vast neurological problems as well as increased rates of cancer. But I bet that detox, especially of hydrophobic chemicals, and maybe hydrophilic as well, might play a role in getting the disc healthier in the back. I bet they would.
I think that's a very good point. I would agree with you. I mean, I think it's one of those things we have to explore more and more of. I do feel like all these toxins, we don't know enough about them. I mean, we don't know good ways in which we can really study. The problem is also with these conditions, it's so hard to study. This is actually know the effect of something like an intervention like you're talking about,
right,
on pain, because back pain is so multifactorial. One of the things, and I'm sure we're going to talk about a little bit more as we go along, is the whole mental aspect of things. The placebo effect is so large in this mm-hmm. population that it's hard to know a lot of times whether these things are going to be helpful. But I do think any kind of anti-inflammatory, antioxidant type of intervention is going to be a positive one, not just for your back, but cardiovascular and every other reason.
Yeah, I had an interesting case the other day. The husband of one of my patients had severe tenous synovitis, could hardly bend his hands, and he got it after going into an office that was newly done, you know, like carpets and everything. And so I've been treating tenous synovitis for many, many years, of course, unsuccessfully, as every surgeon does, because there's no treatment for the tenous synovitis. So I had an idea. I sent him in for a hand bath. I put his hands in the water to suck chemicals out. And he came out. The swelling was down. He could bend his hands with one hand bath. Isn't that amazing? It might be chemical toxicity.
I believe it. I believe it. I mean, there's
no, you know, it's just one patient, but I had another patient who developed tenous synovitis after falling in a puddle of chemicals, and she was laying there for a while. She actually broke her neck, so she has neck surgery, obviously, but she developed tenous synovitis of the upper extremities, not from repetitive motion, like most people do, but from laying in a pool of chemicals. So I'm thinking that we know that chemicals can cause vascular inflammation. They cause a lot of stroke symptoms, like somebody is cleaning inside a closed space with chlorine or some of these other chemicals that you can smell, which means they're hydrophobic. They often get stroke or neurological symptoms. So it inflames the vessels. So I think it can also inflame the tendons, and it probably can inflame anything in the body that it gets to.
Yeah, I think we have so much more to
learn about chemicals,
yeah.
And it's politically incorrect to even talk about chemicals in medicine. You know, that's only supposed to be done by the toxicologist.
Yes, I think you're hitting on a huge point there, and we see this in so many other areas. I mean, you know, you think about, you know, new cars. I had a patient where I was convinced that. It, you know, that the new car, you know, and you know, again, it's an N of one, right? You don't know whether it's really the case, but as soon as they got this new car, the new car smell and everything else, there's a lot of new chemicals in that. And it's amazing how everything changed, and over time it just dissipated away. And it was uncanny, the start of the symptoms. But again, I think we, as you said, we need a lot more research. It's kind of hard to pin a lot of these conditions, and you don't want to say that, you know, our lives are filled with chemicals all around us. So we have to, you know, in some ways be smart about them, but also realize that they are everywhere.
There's an electrolysis foot bath that I came across that will take out hydrophobic chemicals. I have a lot of workman's comp patients that are doused in these chemicals. For some reason, they send me all the chemical burns. So I put them in the foot bath, and the entire room smells like the chemical they were doused in. And then they start to get better. So that's kind of interesting.
That's interesting. You know, I'm a big believer also in just in sweating. I mean, I think sweating
is great.
And Yeah, so I mean, I think that's one of the things, and I didn't put that in the book, which I really should have, because I believe it myself. I do it myself every day. If I'm, I mean, one way or another, whether it be exercise or getting in the sauna and just really sweating it out, I think that's a great way to release toxins that are very difficult.
It certainly is. Yeah, it really is. But, you know, chronically ill people can exercise in that manner. I mean, if you have a real bad back, the exercise to the point where you sweat is difficult. So, you know, we have to use these things before we get to that point.
Right, exactly. I think that's very true. But I would encourage even folks who cannot, you know, feel like they can't exercise at that point. This is one thing we've learned in our clinics here in San Diego, that it all is starting slowly. But if you start with a, you know, with a plan that's not just trying to do it right away, but sometimes you need to be supervision, just like anything else. Sometimes you need a little bit extra help. But over time, I am shocked at how well bodies that are very, very deconditioned, and patients who have a lot of pain, if they're on a sequential program, supervised, they can do incredibly well. So I don't think ever giving up on anybody. I mean there are obviously extremes, but I think the vast majority of people, there's still a lot of recuperative capacity left in your body.
Right. I wanted to spend a minute talking about the mind-body medicine that you discovered at your meditation retreat, and how important it is for taking the emotional component out of pain.
Yes, it's so important. Absolutely. What I discuss in the book is it was a life kind of changing event for me too, where I went to a 10-day meditation course and learned essentially, it was just 10 days of complete silence and just focusing on one's own body and the pain that is, and the pain and sensations that are constantly emitted. And I've seen it so much in patients where a lot of not only stresses, disappointments, cravings, aversions, all the things that we do to try to affect or change life from what it is, or trying to essentially not live in the present moment, all those factors have such a huge physical and almost a direct physical impact on you. Where when I was in that state, I really felt as these sensations were releasing in my body, they were associated with certain bad thoughts or certain cravings or certain aversions or certain ways of thinking that were poor. So, and I see it so much, and it was an aha moment to me, because I really felt like, wow, I see this now with such clarity. And,
right.
And a lot of times,
yeah,
it's hard for us when we see patients because we don't have enough time to really explore the depth of it. But I really encourage everybody to realize that there is a reason behind a lot of these pains and sensations that you may need to dig deep to find.
Yeah, there's a saying that we do not see the world as it is, we see the world as we are. And if we're in a negative and very, you know, emotionally angry and upset and have a lot of anxiety, then life is very different than if you have like a regular meditative practice where you actually increase endorphins. That's been shown. And you increase positive emotions because you can let go of the negative emotions through meditation, then a lot of things somatically do change. And then that brings us to the next thing, which I think you do a very good job in your book of talking about, is why you don't want to go on chronic pain medicine. Narcotic pain medicine decreases endorphins, and we really need endorphins. Without it, oh my God, when people have surgery, when they're on chronic pain medicine, it is so difficult to get control of their post-op pain.
Oh, yes, and you see this, every surgeon sees this, in every aspect of medicine we deal with this, is that these chronic pain patients have a huge difficulty with dealing with normal areas of pain. And there is a condition, you know, called where narcotics actually cause you hyperalgesia or increased pain,
right,
in everything. So you you know, the CDC has tried to address this with these new guidelines, and I think the guidelines are very helpful in that they start to focus on the fact that there's a huge difference between a chronic pain and acute pain. We
right.
do very well with acute pain with pain medication, and there should be no problem, and everybody should not feel bad about treating acute pain. But to make a big kind of mental stop when you realize, okay, my acute pain is over, I need to be off narcotics, even though it feels mm-hmm. a little bit better. So the couple days, 2-3 days after a incident, fine, take a couple of narcotics if the pain is severe. But then after that, we really should be on a thought process that these medications are actually hindering our improvement. And as you mentioned, once you start inhibiting your own body's endorphin production, then it becomes a kind of a cycle where you're constantly craving these medications and you have no way of producing it yourself.
Right.
Like patients on even a couple, let's say, narcotic pain medications a day, do not produce almost anything themselves anymore. So even with exercise, it's not going to help as much. You got to get off those narcotics.
Now there is one thing, I don't know if you've heard of it before, but I want to introduce it to you because it can be very important for your patients, especially those with rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases. It's called low dose naltrexone. Have you heard of that?
No.
Naltrexone is a medicine that's a narcotic antagonist, and they use it to get people off narcotics. And it's similar to Dilaudid, so it can be used for pain, but about at 50 milligrams. But if you use it at 3 to 6 milligrams, depending on the body weight, it'll increase endorphins, and it will increase T-cell immunity. So it fights viruses, fungus, both yeast and mold, which we see in all of these implant patients. And cancer, there's been cures of cancer and autoimmune disease, mainly the intracellular infection part of autoimmune disease, not the chemical toxicity part of autoimmune disease. But in any case, low-dose naltrexone is something that, of course, most doctors don't know about it because it's already a generic drug and they can't make money on it. And it's compounded. You compound it. I use muscle testing, but you can pretty much, if somebody weighs 110, they're going to be down at 3 milligrams, and if they weigh 180, they're going to be up at 6 milligrams, maybe even 8 milligrams. So you put them on that, and they stay on it for a long time, and their T-cell immunity goes up, their endorphins go up, their pain goes down, and everybody's happy.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, that's fascinating. I'm going to look that up.
I know, look it up. Yeah, it's fun.
Really,
yeah, there's all sorts
bad.
Of MS, by the way, is an intracellular spirochete, and there's all sorts of cures of MS on this. Because, of course, MS, you know, reverts all the time. You know, about one-third of MS just goes away, right? So if you give them something to really help that, then even more MS will go away. The body comes in and the immune system takes care of the infection. So, as I said before, you have to know the cause of the disease to treat it. When you don't know the cause of the disease, all you're treating is the symptoms. And the patient may feel better, but they're not going to get better.
Yes, I love it. I got to research some more on this. You told me. I think I like all these things I'm learning, and I that's going to be one of my set questions now about breast implants for sure.
Yeah.
And also
yeah.
A little bit more about all
especially
these other
especially in the
factors.
Shoulder. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, great. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Sure. As far as the book is concerned, the book Take Back Control, A Surgeon's Guide to Healing Your Spine Without Injections or Surgery is on Amazon as well as its own website, which is called just www.takebackcontrol.com. And we have a bunch of exercises as well as a program that can help with exercises and home remedies as far as back pain on that. And also, I'd encourage listeners to look at our spinezone.com website, which is our exercise. And as I was discussing, our multidisciplinary program that involves all different aspects of spine care all under one roof here in San Diego. And that's what we're trying to expand also kind of as a national paradigm shift in the way spine is being treated.
Well, I think your ideas are wonderful. I really love interviewing surgeons. You know, we're a breed among ourselves. We have our own problems and issues and patient problems and everything that we can relate to. So it's a lot of fun to interview another surgeon.
Yes, I really appreciate it. I learned a lot from speaking to you, and I'd love to get more information and read more about what you have done.
So you can call me or email me anytime. I'll email you my email address when I get off. But it's been great talking to you. We've been interviewing Dr. Razdadin on his book, Take Back Control. He is an orthopedic spine surgeon with some great ideas about how to save the healthcare system, probably hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars, if not more, because spine surgery is very, very expensive, and has great ideas in the book. And I encourage anybody with back or neck issues to read the book. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
This is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We are going to be interviewing, next week it's the Simplicity of Stillness Method by Marlise Carlin, and then we're going to be interviewing again Carl Callahan, The Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization, and then the next week is Dr. Briner on Whole Body Dentistry. Thank you very much, and join us next week.